You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Alterman is a columnist for The Nation, and that means his politics are quite liberal. He argues that liberalism is actually at the vital center of American politics. And in his latest book, Why We're Liberals, a political handbook for post-Bush America, he lays out the historical roots of liberalism, explains some of its policy missteps, and how conservatives have waged a successful campaign against the policy supported by liberals. Also how liberals can reclaim their past and create a new political future. His book is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Alterman back to the show today.
So thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to see you. Part one of your book is a historic look at liberalism. Like its counterpart conservatism, it's come to mean a number of things over the years. But what did it start out representing?
Well, classical liberalism is a very widely held creed. It includes people like Ted Kennedy, as well as people like Margaret Thatcher and Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan. And classical liberalism is really just the inheritance of the Enlightenment, which argues the theme of the Enlightenment, according to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, is dare to know. And the idea behind it is that human beings have a right to follow their own beliefs as far as they lead. We don't, the church doesn't shut us up. God doesn't shut us up. The dictatorship of the proletariat doesn't shut us up. The fatherland doesn't shut us up. We all have the same right to achieve what we want to achieve. We all have the same right to freedom, and we don't. We as a community, we seek the best answers we can find.
Well, the liberals of the 19th century in England were what we might call libertarians today, but we're not talking about that, are we? We're talking more about the liberals that grow out of John Dewey.
There was a historic transformation of liberalism because. Around the time of the Great Depression, people started to figure out, during the Progressive Era, but it came to fruition in terms of its practice in Franklin Roosevelt's government, that these ideals were not practicable, they were not pragmatic, because they were forces in society that combined to make them meaningless in practical terms, so that you could proclaim yourself as free as you wanted, but if you had to work 16 hours a day with no health care and no benefits and no one on your side, then it was a kind of meaningless right. And so liberalism became a much more pragmatic creed, and that's where you separate classical liberalism from contemporary liberalism, because those liberals, John Dewey, Franklin Roosevelt, and later John Rawls, started to argue that there's a whole set of institutions that society needs to create to make these freedoms meaningful. And one of those institutions is the government. The government needs to be powerful enough to prevent other forces, like big business, for instance, from keeping people from living out their liberal lives. And so liberals use government as a pragmatic tool. Liberals don't believe in government the way conservatives are against the government. It's not the same thing. Liberals are not as ideological as conservatives. Liberals believe that for pragmatic reasons, government is sometimes the answer. It's often not the answer.
And most Americans would have subscribed to the New Deal. Even many Republicans don't want to give up the things that were gained by the New Deal. So when did the word liberal become such a loaded term? I mean, before it was co-opted by Showtime, I think it is. The L word actually was referred to liberals, and it was the right word you couldn't say anymore.
Right. It's a question as to whether or not it's more controversial to be a lesbian or a liberal right now. It's funny.
Although they both seem to take off their clothes at inopportune times.
Well, inopportune is a question of judgment, wouldn't you say? In any case, back to business at hand. It's funny that for a long time, conservatives claimed to be liberals. I mean, Richard Nixon claimed to be a liberal. Dwight Eisenhower thought it was a good idea.
Tom Wicker called Richard Nixon the last liberal because of so many of the policies of his administration.
Right, but even Richard Nixon called himself a liberal. And even Joe McCarthy, believe it or not, accused liberals of betraying liberalism. Like, he thought to be a liberal was a good thing. It's just that these guys were bad liberals, the way I do, actually, with conservatives today. And John Kennedy, who's the last presidential candidate to say, I'm a liberal, he spoke to the New York Liberal Party as Senator Kennedy in 1960, and he said, if by liberal, which meant that the term was already on the defensive somewhat, he said, if by liberal you mean I'm terrible in all these ways, then of course I'm not a liberal. But if you mean by liberal, and then he filled the definition with his own idea of it, he said, then I'm proud to call myself a liberal. No politician has done that since.
Well, he was probably responding to Eisenhower calling liberalism the equivalent of creeping socialism. But nowadays, I gather it's better to use the word progressive.
Absolutely. The numbers tell you, if you're a politician, you gain an immediate 19 points, which is almost twice. You almost double your popularity by calling yourself a progressive over a liberal. That's one reason I wrote this book. That's a shame. That's wrong.
Well, progressive used to mean further to the left than liberal, didn't it?
Well, liberals were anti-communist and progressives were not necessarily anti-communist. That's one big difference. That's one reason I'm a liberal, by the way.
Eric Alterman's latest book is Why We're Liberals, a political handbook for post-Bush America, published by Viking. You've called one of your chapters What Do Liberals Believe Anyway? So do you want to lay that out?
Well, I'm glad I'm here to do that, Leonard, because I couldn't do it on a lot of shows. The problem with liberalism is it's rather hard to define. It's a big problem. Lionel Trilling, the literary critic, called it a kind of temperament rather than an ideology. Conservatism is actually...
And liberals were down on him in the later years of his life. They didn't think of him as a liberal anymore.
Well, I think more radicals didn't think of him as a liberal. I mean, liberalism was kind of hijacked by radicals.
In the late 60s
and early 70s. More in the 70s than the 60s. And a lot of things went wrong with liberalism. And I actually hold liberals and liberalism responsible for a lot of their problems. Problems I think have been fixed in the past decade, but nevertheless, in some respects, they got what they deserved. But to try and answer your question, what do liberals believe in? They believe in the Enlightenment, and they believe in the necessity of working together as a society in a pragmatic way to realize those ideals. The conservatives basically say you're on your own. Here's your society. Here's your opportunity. Go get it. But liberals say, no, people aren't born with equal opportunity. And we need to take certain steps in certain areas to make those promises real. And it's a situation-by-situation question as to what kinds of steps you need to take. You don't need a government. You don't need a Katrina-style government without a Katrina. But when you have a Katrina, you sure as hell do need one. And in extreme situations, everybody understands you need a government. But simply to make things fair in terms of schooling, in terms of access to health care, in terms of the kinds of things that we all need to be who we want to be, well, liberals believe in addressing those things. And conservatives really say, if you're born without those resources, you know, tough luck.
You're right that the Democratic Party has moved to the right while its base and many Americans have moved to the left. Why? How do you explain that disconnect?
Well, the reason... In some ways, the Democratic Party has moved to the left because the South has left the Democratic Party. And so what was always a conservative anchor there is gone. But the positions that the Democratic Party have taken have moved to the right because the political system has moved to the right. But public opinion has not followed that political system. Public opinion has moved somewhat to the left.
So why did George Bush get reelected then?
See, I have a very long chapter saying, so what's the problem? And there's a lot of problems. Some of them are liberals' own fault. Some of them are that the media parrot conservative propaganda. The opinion media is quite conservative. We can argue about whether or not you think reporters are liberals, but the punditocracy is not liberal at all, and they dominate our discourse. And part of the problem is it's God's fault. I mean, you and I here living in Manhattan, our vote is worth about like 1/70th of what it would be worth if we lived in Wyoming, and 1/300th of what it would be worth if we lived in Alaska. Now, I'll give you an example of how the world is just unfair. In 1994, we had the Gingrich Revolution, remember? Mm-hmm. And everybody said, oh, the country's become conservative, and Time magazine had charging elephants on the cover. And then 2 years ago, we had a move back to the center, right, in 2006, and Time magazine had the center on the cover. I forget the exact graphic. Well, in fact, the transformation in 2006 was larger than the transformation in 2004. A larger percentage of the people who voted Democratic in 2006 than in 1994. And the change was also bigger by a percentage in 2006 than in 1994. But in 1994, the Republicans got more seats And they got more change seats. Why? Because they're better distributed out there. There's only, you know, 20 people per whatever, you know, in Wyoming and places that are by definition Republican. Whereas we're all crowded here in our cities, and so our votes are badly distributed. That's one reason.
Well, how do you explain John Edwards' problems? He took the most liberal position during this primary season, and he didn't get the support of the voters.
Well, one problem with liberalism is that it's been largely defined by identity politics in recent decades, and that's a problem that's not going away. I'm not sure. I mean, John Edwards, he did take the most liberal positions, but he didn't have the most liberal history. I mean, you had to believe that you had to believe in John Edwards' transformation. And you also had to say yourself that the judgment that his apology for the war was more important than Barack Obama's being right on the war. And you also had to say that the fact of having a black or a female candidate symbolically was more important than having a white male who had the right positions. You can't extrapolate from the fact that Edwards was not popular, even though he was the most progressive, the fact that that means liberalism is not the most popular, because an awful lot of our politics really is about personality, not about politics.
So are you arguing that one problem liberals have is that they're saddled with identity politics?
Well, I think we've mostly moved beyond identity politics. I think an awful lot of women are voting for Barack Obama, and some blacks are supporting Hillary Clinton, and a lot of white males are supported both of them over John Edwards. So I think we've made a lot of progress. And I do think we paid an enormous price for it, I'll say that.
Are those decisions based on things like which one is more liberal?
No. I think, you know, it's not that simple a term. First of all, both Obama and Hillary Clinton reject the term liberal. They're not willing to make the fight that John Kennedy made in 1960. It's a much harder fight. I understand. I regret it, but I understand. I don't think Edwards ever called himself a liberal. Edwards called himself progressive, and populist progressive. That's what people want to be today. You know, there wasn't really much of a difference between Edwards and Clinton and Obama on the issues. I just don't think it's useful. That's not a distinction that I would make. I think the sort of race between Lieberman and Lamont, there was a liberal challenging a center-right conservative, and liberals knew which side they were on in that one. And it didn't work out in the end, but you had a nice, clear definition. And the entire media was on Lieberman's side. I mean, with the exception of the New York Times editorial page. I mean, if you read the opening of my book, I have all of these so-called liberal pundits saying this is the end of the world.
The liberal black mayor of Newark went to back Lieberman in that election.
So did Barack Obama.
My guest is Eric Alterman, whose latest book is Why We're Liberals, A Political Handbook for Post-Bush America. It's published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Eric Alterman, whose latest book is follow-up to What Liberal Media is Why We're Liberals, a Political Handbook for Post-Bush America, and it's published by Viking. And before we get back to you, a listener wrote, what exactly did you mean, talking to me, about your comment that both liberals and lesbians remove their clothes at inappropriate times, because the way I interpreted it was offensive. What I meant, and I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it, now I am, is that on the L Word, the television show, these gorgeous lesbians all take off their clothes for the edification, I think, probably of a lot of male viewers, and that seems to me to be inappropriate. And I was thinking about Elliot Spitzer and some other people who have been in high office who've also taken off their clothes at inappropriate times. And I'm sorry if it was a weak joke, and I'll never do it again. Eric, you write that one of your main objectives in getting this book out there is to set the record straight on liberals and conservatives, to correct the lies, half-truths, and outdated assumptions about liberals on issues like which party is more fiscally responsible, for example.
Well, there's no question, if you look at the numbers, that Republicans have increased government by far larger size than Democrats have.
Well, so the Democrats are the tax and spend party. The Republicans are tax decrease and spend party. Is that what you're saying?
Republicans don't tax. They spend, but they don't tax. And so the size of government goes up. Bill Clinton reduced the size of government as a percentage of GDP by about 1%. George Bush has increased it by 3%.
Would you call Bill Clinton a liberal?
I said Democrats and Republicans. I didn't say liberals. We're talking in relative terms. No, I would say our last liberal president was Franklin Roosevelt.
Not LBJ?
Well, LBJ did certain liberal things. I mean, he was very committed to his civil rights agenda, for sure, and he was a leader in that. And I think what he did was very brave. I mean, he said, I'm destroying the Democratic Party in the South for the next generation, and he went ahead and did it anyway. But he was not a liberal. I mean, he spent his whole life on the conservative as a Texas Democrat. Texas Democrats were not liberals in those days.
What about the whole matter of judicial activism?
Oh, you see, that's a very clear case. How do you measure judicial activism? Well, I think there's two possible ways. One is how often does the court overturn a law passed by Congress? And the second one would be how often does the court overturn one of the court's own precedents? In both of those cases, again, significantly more precedents and laws have been overturned by justices appointed by Republicans than by Democrats. Same's true, by the way. Democrats are supposed to be good at distributing the gains of economic growth, and Republicans are supposed to be good at stimulating the growth itself. Wrong. The Democratic presidents have had much better records of economic growth than Republican presidents.
Getting back to judicial activism, yeah. I think one of the main areas of concern is Roe v. Wade, and even supporters of choice, liberals, have told me that they thought that the court made a poor decision there, that they should have argued, come up with the decision based on other things, and that was a clear case of activism.
Yeah, I run into some trouble with liberals on this. There's a few instances where my position is, I say, liberals, let's rethink this, and Roe v. Wade is one of them. I don't really like Roe v. Wade, in part for the reason that you've just described, although I'm not a legal expert, so I couldn't even tell you why it's a bad decision, but people I trust tell me it is. The reason I don't like Roe v. Wade is because I'm a Democrat, small d, and I think that this war, this battle, should be fought democratically. I think liberals have engendered enormous resentment over the fact that when they can't win elections, they win court cases, and that these enormous changes in people's lives are imposed by the courts, and that has given conservatives a really powerful appeal to populists, which, if you read a book like What's the Matter with Kansas, they've built entire movements just on this issue alone. I would rather win that right democratically than win it judicially. And by the way, it's basically lost in most places that you want it judicially anyway. In the state of Mississippi, a state of 3 million people, there's a grand total of one place you can get an abortion in that state. And it's rather dangerous to go there because there's always people protesting outside. And I was in contact with an organization called Americans United for Life, and they rate Mississippi as only the eighth best state in the country. So in the eighth worst from the standpoint of people who support the right to choice, there's one abortion clinic for 3 million people. So if George Bush won single women without a college education in 2004. I don't think he would have won them if they knew that they were voting away their right to choice.
What about the charge against liberals that they're too cavalier about protecting our national security? Everyone seemed to jump on Barack Obama when he said that he'd talk to all of our enemies without any preconditions. Wasn't that being soft on dictators?
My parents always taught me that you're not too tough to talk to anyone. I mean, talking is a sign of strength, in my view, not being afraid to talk to anyone. We have 16 U.S. intelligence agencies telling us that we are less safe because we invaded Iraq. We have the military stretched beyond its breaking point. I can give you example after example of how the national security of this country has been weakened. We have increased the terrorist threat, all because we followed the tough guy, no-think rhetoric of the conservative Republicans in this. So if you look at what does it mean to protect the United States, it means reducing the number of people who want to kill us. It means keeping our military strong and well-protected and making sure they have the equipment they need to do their mission. And it means honoring that service. And the Republicans and conservatives have treated the military with absolute contempt, and they have used it for things that of which it's no value, and thereby created a real counterproductive backlash. And this is actually a terrible problem for liberals, because actually this is why George Bush won the election in 2004. The scariest statistic that I heard in 2000 after that election was not about values, but it was that 18% of the people, it was an 18% gap on who was tougher on security between Bush and Kerry. And yet still a small plurality of voters thought that Iraq had made us less safe rather than more safe, even back then in 2004. Now it's enormous. Now it's 65%. But back then it was 48 to 44. So what in the hell is going on when people who think that the one thing that George Bush did made us less safe, and yet they still by 18% margin say that those people made us more secure? That's because people don't trust liberals when it comes to security. And one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is give people the actual data, the actual information that will allow them to rethink this perception that conservatives have and the media have created about liberals.
My guest is Eric Alterman, whose latest book is Why We're Liberals, a political handbook for post-Bush America, published by Viking. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and a listener writes that he doesn't think that you can call yourself a liberal because you have been so outraged by Ralph Nader, who is a real liberal.
I think Ralph Nader is a Leninist, not a liberal. Ralph Nader is someone who argues that things have to get worse before they can get better. And so the thing to do was to elect George Bush. Ralph Nader actively supported the election of George Bush. He promised his contributors that he would not campaign in swing states. And then he went into those swing states with the money that he had raised from those same contributors in order to elect George Bush, because he said that the Democrats would become more progressive if we had to live through a Bush presidency. Well, he was right. They have become more progressive. So in that sense, Nader was successful. He was successful at the cost of the Iraq War, at the cost of the tax cut, at the cost of the destruction of the environment, at the cost of all of these horrible things that would not have happened if Ralph Nader had gone on the air the night before the election and said, this was a great campaign, we raised a lot of great issues, we're not going away, we're going to hold President Gore's feet to the fire, but this Bush fellow is too dangerous to be president of the most powerful nation in the world. He didn't do it, and that's why we're in this situation today.
You mentioned the environment. Bob Shrum claims that Al Gore kept the environment and global warming out of the 2000 campaign altogether because it was feared that it would get him labeled a liberal. Why has that been seen as a liberal cause rather than as a scientific one?
First of all, I don't believe what political consultants say, period. So is he saying he told Al Gore to keep it?
Well, his handlers were telling Al Gore to do it, and Al Gore didn't, and Al Gore listened to them.
Well, see, that's not exactly accurate in my view. Al Gore really wanted to make a speech about the environment, and his handlers told him, don't do it because everyone who cares about the environment is already voting for you, and you're not going to get any votes that way. And the mistake that they made is nobody understood that Gore had passion about anything. If he could have demonstrated some passion about the environment, it would have helped him, I think.
So is this really a liberal-conservative issue? Are only liberals concerned about global warming?
Well, this is my argument about the fact that roughly 70% of Americans are actually liberal by our contemporary definition of liberal, because the conservatives have become so ideological that they reject science. They reject normative knowledge. What is their argument against stem cell research? That God tells them that it's wrong to pursue it. That's not an argument. That's that you might feel that belief. You may not want to be a stem cell researcher. I can respect that. But the arguments that conservatives make, they're just simply based on ideology. This is my fundamental argument. They have become dominated by an ideologically extremist group. And so merely to be liberal is just to be a pragmatist in our society today.
Jeffrey writes in, Phil Oakes satirized liberals in his song, Love Me, I'm a Liberal, because I always feel like they're so put upon. Phil Oakes was a liberal, but he thought it was funny.
Yeah, Izzy Stone called Phil Oakes something like a snotty little kid at the time. I like that song. I love Phil Oakes. Liberals made a lot of mistakes in the 1960s, the Vietnam War being a rather large one. I think that song's kind of unfair. I think liberals were very good on civil rights. But the fact is that the new left arose because there were certain contradictions in liberalism that liberals didn't want to deal with in the 1960s. And it was, in some sense, in the beginning, the Port Huron Statement was a very positive development. But, I would put up the judgment of those liberals who were being mocked by the new left against the final, the way the new left developed, any day of the week. I'm much happier to be associated with a sort of 1950s liberalism for all of its flaws than I am with what the new left turned into.
I mean, Schlesinger and Wexler and people like that?
Yeah, Joseph Rao.
In part two of your book, you address some commonly stated beliefs about liberals. Why do liberals hate patriotism? Why are liberals so damn elitist? Why do liberals always blame America first? And why are liberals so nasty? The Observer review of the book jokes that the common conception of liberals is that they are nasty, God-hating, baby-killing, smut-loving, elitist, anti-American wimps. You're saying none of that is true?
I'm saying it's much truer about the conservatives who level the charges. The conservatives level these charges, and that wouldn't really bother me. I don't like people who complain about their reviews. I'm just going to complain about this one tiny aspect of the reviews. People think I'm arguing with Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly. I'm not. What I'm saying is that these views permeate the media, and they're taken quite treated quite respectably within the mainstream media. But if you take a look at the accusations, they fit the conservatives much more closely than they do liberals, and hence ought to be discredited. And the media and our politicians ought to stop treating them as if they're serious. That's my argument.
But Eric, you do understand why some argue that you're making the same mistake many feel Air America made, that instead of setting the agenda, liberals tend to publicize the arguments of their critics as they attack them. And their Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, they are setting the agenda, as Karl Rove did from the White House.
You know, I'm going to make an admission here. I hate it when people review books that the reviewer hasn't written. I think it's a cardinal error. And so I kind of hated the New York Times review of my book, and most of the reviews in this respect, except that it would have been great had I done the book that people keep saying I should have done, which is Arthur Schlesinger's The Vital Center, rewritten for today. And I would have actually liked to have done that book, and that book was kind of in my book proposal, but it turns out I'm no Arthur Schlesinger. So I wrote the book that I was capable of writing, and I think it's a, you know, I don't want to sound defensive, it's a damn useful thing to have. There's 1,000 footnotes in this book in terms of, it's not, I'm not arguing with Bill O'Reilly, I'm arguing with the perception of the mainstream media, many of whom call themselves liberals. Nick Kristof, in the New York Times, liberal columns, terrific reporter in Africa and so forth, he equates, he's done it twice, the Swift Boat lies about John Kerry with a liberal's refusal to endorse his view of free trade. In other words, there is this Stockholm syndrome in the media on the part of reporters and on the part of many liberals that has led them to embrace this senseless and outdated conservative critique. And I'm just trying to give them what someone in the Times this week said are intellectual vitamins. So I cop to that accusation.
Despite what I just said, how do you explain the prominence of Ann Coulter and her success?
You know, I was sitting there when Ann Coulter was invented. We were both hired at MSNBC in 1996, and she was just a congressional aide with a bony ass and long legs. And am I allowed to say that?
I don't know. That same listener might write in again.
Oh. I mean, she was just this very odd-looking but striking presence, and she would say the craziest things. You'd start to listen to her, and then the end of the sentence, you couldn't believe your ears.
Yeah, let's bomb the New York Times.
She would refer to the president and his wife as white trash on the air, and every once in a while they would come out and fire her, like at the break, and then but they couldn't live without her. It was a symbiotic relationship, and she has been booked, according to Media Matters, for whom I work, over 200 times on various NBC affiliates since she left MSNBC. And they book her because she says these things. Ann Coulter's quoted in my book saying to conservatives, don't worry about calling liberals names like faggot. It's been great for my career. The last thing you have to do is be afraid of calling liberals names. And she's absolutely right. So I'm saying to the system, if you're producing an Ann Coulter or a Jonah Goldberg with this nutty book, Liberal Fascism, clearly there's something wrong with the system, and clearly the liberals that you have are not liberals who are willing to stand up for themselves against this conservative onslaught.
Well, I remember every review of Jonah Goldberg's book pointing out that he claims Mussolini was a socialist, and they all say that's not true, but book reviews don't seem to matter in situations like that.
Well, Coulter, in the beginning, her first book was treated very respectfully. George Will would quote it. In other words, there's a kind of conservative baseline where they take care of their own, and Goldberg's book was also treated quite respectfully in the New York Times Book Review by David Oshinsky, I believe.
Really?
Yeah. And And I just think that this what I talked about in that book, What Liberal Media, this working of the refs has been so effective that look at the New York Times hiring Bill Kristol. What is that about? They had to pick the pundit with the worst record in all of America about Iraq war, and the one who has the least amount of respect for honesty and
so
forth.
I thought it was to take the heat off of David Brooks. No longer are people writing as many angry letters about David Brooks. They now have Billy Kristol to go after.
Well, I can't. I did actually write an article about this for the American Prospect. But it said to the New York Times, what the New York Times was saying is that we are ashamed of our community. We are ashamed to be perceived as a liberal paper. We are wherever the establishment is. And Bill Kristol, no matter what crazy things he said, no matter the damage that he's done, no matter the lack of responsibility he's taken for the positions and the problems he's created, his advice has created for this country, that he's still considered a respectable voice. People have pointed out that in all the 5-year retrospectives of the war, or 6 years, everyone who's invited to do it, and this is true, again, of the liberal New York Times editorial page, are people who supported the war. There's something, you sort of demonstrate your bona fides in this country by taking the right-wing position. And again, it's because liberals are not standing up for themselves.
Eric Alterman is Distinguished Professor of English at Brooklyn College, also Professor of Journalism at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He is the liberal media columnist for The Nation, the Altercation web blogger for Media Matters for America, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, and a history consultant for HBO Films. His latest book is, and it's his seventh, is Why We're Liberals, a Political Handbook for Post-Bush America, published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Leonard. I appreciate it.